Imagine there's no heaven. It's easy if you try. No hell below us. Above us only sky. Imagine all the people living for today. So welcome. My name is Anne Wilson, and it is an absolute pleasure to host Emerge Australia's podcast series for 2026 as part of our focus on World ME Awareness Week. This year, as in past years, I have the pleasure to interview clinicians and researchers as well as people with lived experience of ME/CFS, long COVID and infection-associated chronic illnesses. I acknowledge the traditional custodians of country and their connections to land, sea and community, and pay my respect to elders past and present, noting their continuing contributions, struggles and achievements. And in this case, I think that also involves traditional custodians of country in the US. As we continue to reflect on the magnificent lyrics of John Lennon's Imagine, I just can't help to imagine a world where the brotherhood of man is celebrated globally, and for our listeners to live in a world without war, without stigma or discrimination, a world where we have equity of access to treatments, to clinical services and to cures. And that certainly in this day and age is something worth imagining about, but actively visualizing and making happen. Today's podcast is part of a clinical series that Emerge Australia is recording. It's a platform where we can together explore the pressing issues faced by 250,000 people with ME/CFS and at least 400,000 more with long COVID in Australia. I'm delighted to interview today Talia Ruscioni, Executive Director of Bateman Horn Center in the US. Talia is a healthcare leader with over 20 years' experience across direct patient care, public health advocacy, and medical education. After beginning her career in intensive care and rehabilitation, she moved into systems level work, including statewide trauma informed training for adult protective services in Colorado, before leading clinician education across a 7-state hospital network at the University of Utah Health. Since joining the Bateman Horn Center as executive director in 2019, she has built the Medical Education Resource Center, MERC, into a globally recognized training hub, reaching over 13,000 healthcare professionals across 90 countries through accredited programs in ME/CFS, long COVID and related post-infectious conditions. Her work spans partnerships with the NIH, the CDC, institutions across Australia and organisations like Emerge Australia, also across Canada and the UK, and most recently, BHC's Clinical Care Guide, a practical clinical resource for providers managing complex multi-system illness. It gives me great pleasure to welcome Talia to this podcast. Welcome, Talia.
Thank you, Anne. I'm so grateful to be here.
Well, we're delighted to have you. Of course, a lot of our listeners wouldn't be aware of is that Emerge Australia and Bateman Horn Center, through your work, have been working now for several years on the production of joint resources which obviously we promote on both our websites. So you're not new to us, and I certainly understand Bateman Horn Center is not new to our listeners. So that just underscores why we're so delighted to have you on this podcast. So let's get into it, I guess, and learn a bit more about you and your career path and the work that you do at Bateman Horn and how your experience has carved the way for all of the wonderful programs that you are managing and leading at Bateman Horn. So to start off with, can you share how your diverse career path from bedside care to medical education reform has shaped your approach to patient advocacy and the development of the medical education resource, MERC?
I just want to take a few steps back and say that I have so greatly enjoyed working with Emerge Australia, and a little sad at the promotion that I received last year because it meant that I had to step back from working with your team. And I immediately knew when we connected that we were long going to be partners in this field because we're very much aligned in this work. So I wanted to say that before we dig in. As for my healthcare background, it is very diverse. I've held a lot of interesting roles over the years. Even when I was in college, I was working as a therapeutic rehabilitation technician for the city of Colorado Springs, and I was creating individualized care plans and programs to help those with intellectual and developmental disabilities. And I loved working in that very person-centered way to help improve function, quality of life, and just, you know, really meeting people where they are. So you'll kind of see that's a little bit of a trend in my career path. And so after college, I connected in with a local level one trauma center where I was a rehabilitation technician. And I learned so much about the healthcare system there, not just the full continuum of care for patients from, you know, the emergency room to inpatient to outpatient recovery, but really understanding how policy impacts funding decisions so greatly and how that impacts what the providers that are employed by that health system, but also how those patients are, you know, received within that healthcare system and what supports they are allotted. And a little piece of that is that kind of injustice flag that got triggered for me early on in the health system. And yet working with the physical occupational speech therapist that I did, we were able to touch patient lives in a different way because we were able to help them live inside their bodies while recovering from a condition. And so a lot of that, I think, helped me in my role at Bateman Horn Center, especially with such multi-system complex diseases, try to see the whole person, not just the label or the diagnosis. And so I would say that a lot of my bedside care really shaped what I do now on top of the system level medical education work that I did at the University of Utah.
Yeah, I think that the point you raise, which funnily enough, no one has raised in podcasts with me before, is seeing the whole person. We talk about holistic care, but to be able to see the whole person, not just their condition, is just such an incredible insight, and I would think would be unbelievably validating for the person with the condition to know that you're not just seeing the fact that they have got deficits that they are unable to perform in, but you're seeing the impact that their condition has on their whole life. And I guess trying to work towards not having their condition define them.
Exactly. And that's hard. And I'll be honest, I am a person now with long COVID ME, and that is the hardest part, even when living with this yourself, is accepting that shift, but also trying to advocate for yourself, your loved one. You know, I think everybody knows by now that my sister is a huge part of my why. Seeing her struggle with this illness in a severe way for many years, it is that defining piece of like, I'm still a whole person. I'm not just a list of diagnoses that continue to grow. And how can we be seen in both policy, but within our health systems as that whole person and receive care in that way? Yeah.
Do you think it's the same for other diseases? Is it like a person with cancer, is it more difficult or the same for them to be defined, you know, as a whole person rather than a person with cancer? Does the disease
I would hope in general we would shift our language and our narratives a little bit more. It's not, you know, that person isn't cancer. They have cancer, right? They are a person that is battling cancer. We are a person with ME/CFS. So it's not defining us, right? And that's a huge part of what we do at Bateman Horne Center and some of our social media and our campaigns is we are still people, right? And what I've loved being able to do through the medical education world is to bring in those lived experience professionals to help shape the very products that we put out. You know, they are still the training that they received as a physical therapist who now lives with severe ME, right? Or they are still an anesthesiologist at a world-renowned college, but now they can channel that expertise in another way. Like we are still our training, we are still all the beautiful things that we love to do. We just have this illness. And so I think to your point, it's a matter of reframing. And in other conditions, I think it's a little bit easier to do because there's so much recognition and support. And that is something that remains lacking for ME.
Yeah. Because I think I just sort of put an example of myself. Yes, I'm the CEO of Emerge Australia, but my title doesn't define who I am. I may also have condition A, B, C, and D. They don't define what I am either. Because at the core, I'm who I am. I'm a mother and an ex-wife and all of those things is like that inner core of this is me. And
yes.
I think about that. I think about what happens when something is taken away. What happens if someone loses their job and they're defined by their status? How can they find their way back to like their core? And does that happen? Can that happen for someone with ME/CFS? So is it more difficult for someone with ME/CFS not to be defined by their illness?
That's a good question. And I think it's harder for people with more of the invisible illnesses because we are defined by what is mirrored back to us, right? And if we are mirrored back with disbelief or stigma or misunderstanding or even mismanagement of care due to a lack of education or knowledge around the disease, we start to internalize that as part of our identity. Like we start to redefine who we are based on how we see ourselves reflected. And I think that that's something really hard to break with any chronic illness, but especially this one that's so under-recognized. And so Timothy Wyman is our wonderful LCSW, and I listen to our support groups, and he has a very beautiful way of saying that when you live with a chronic illness, regardless of what it is, you have to redefine and you get to redefine who you are constantly. And what a beautiful thing that is. So while, you know, I may have been in my, you know, pre-illness life, a mountaineer and I loved hiking 14ers here in Colorado and stuff. But now what am I, right? Like I get to use my brain. I get to redefine my creativity in a different way. And that reimagining who you are can be a really powerful and beautiful thing if we can reach that place.
I love the way you said that. For us Aussies here, What is LC, whatever?
SW, a licensed clinical social worker.
Oh, right. Okay. We just call them social workers, but a licensed clinical social worker.
Yeah. Sorry.
Yeah. Offline, I have to ask you how you get to be a licensed clinical social worker. So just on to my next question. You've been, through your work at Bateman Horne, so instrumental in elevating the global standard of care for patients with ME/CFS. How has your collaboration with other institutions, organizations worldwide, particularly Australia, Canada, UK, etc., influenced the development of either clinical guidelines or improved patient outcomes, etc.?
I love that question because I love talking about all my colleagues around the world. I have just absolutely treasured working with so many amazing, talented, beautiful, skilled, caring people. And what I would say I've learned in this kind of multi-country, multi-region collaboration is that at the core, we have a standard of care that we are trying to reach for patients, right? We may have health systems that work differently. We may have insurances, payers that influence, you know, how providers are allowed to practice medicine. We may have different names for medications or, you know, all of these things. But at the core, we are still patients with ME/CFS, and we want to find that common thread that ties us together in a way to say this is the standard of care approach for every person. Now, there may be additional things that are added onto that or, you know, different treatment modalities or interventions based on how your country practices and its progression. But at the core, we should be meeting this. And I think that we have been able to really define that. I would even say that that's something that it was fun kind of watching with our release of the clinical care guide. Not only have I seen very similar conversations between our countries talking about what is that standard and how do we get people to see that, but I saw that even with our experts under one roof at Bateman Horne Center, right? So while they all may have a slightly different approach to how they manage the care or they go about their diagnoses or whatnot, there is a core common piece that we would call standardization. And that's largely where that resource guide came from, is trying to channel that into a place that gave voice to all of this.
Yeah. Of course, in Australia, we are currently in the process of developing a new clinical guideline for ME/CFS and associated conditions. So we don't have that standard of care yet. We have got a clinical health pathway that we've developed, but we look forward to the day where the structural and regulatory frameworks within which clinicians need to operate are in fact developed and approved and will make an impact for patients. So we're not there yet, but we're getting
it. I think sometimes you're further along than we are, and yet I think it is through these partnerships that we find that strength, because that is something that we can go back and say, we may be two different countries operating in different ways, but we believe that this is the standard, right? And that gives us strength.
Yeah, well, definitely, you know, and we've had this discussion also with Dr. Bateman, you know, our health systems are very different. And when it comes to clinician education, which is what we collaborate on, apart from patient resources, we have greater ease of access to a clinical workforce than you do in the United States. So,
yeah,
you know, that's one of those things where you've got the standard of care, but being able to access most of your clinicians to be able to take it on board or do the education or understand what the baseline is. It, of course, in a country as large as the United States, it's much more challenging.
It is. And there are so many layers that you have to get through and cut through to reach either that systemic core of change. You know, where does this all start? the Federation of State Medical Boards, state licensing boards, you know, the governing entities that influence what's taught in medical school. Like, there's so many layers that we have to cut through and reach. And that's been a learning process, but it's starting to tip in the right direction, albeit slow. And I think it's largely because the staggering numbers of long COVID patients that are not getting better, as we all know, are likely meeting the criteria for ME/CFS or ME. It's in your face now in a way that we can't deny. And so there's more people asking more questions.
Yeah, I think that's the same here in Australia, although we actually have some clinicians in Australia that think COVID is over. So there's an attitude amongst some of our clinicians. And the only reason I raise that is that we go to a lot of our clinical education is actually done at major GP conferences. And we're there and we talk to the clinicians and we have a presentation about ME/CFS that is accredited. And when we talk to the clinicians, it is unbelievable how many people think that, well, it's not a big deal. Long COVID's not a big deal and COVID's over anyway. Do you hear that, any of that in the US, or is it just us?
I'm going to be careful with my answer, but I think that everyone knows how different our administration has made our healthcare landscape within America. And so, yes, we hear that a lot. And I would say that it's such a shame, because why would we be naive enough to believe that the flu comes back every year, but COVID isn't, right? Like, why would we believe that EBV exists, but the SARS-CoV-2 virus doesn't still exist? Like, we don't get rid of these things. And just because we may be more, you know, we have more of that natural immunity, the herd immunity at this point, we're still getting vaccines, is this false belief that we're safe? And I think it, unfortunately, this is such a cruel way of saying this, but it takes you knowing somebody who didn't get better to believe it. Or it takes yourself not getting better to believe it. And at that point, it's too late, you know, instead of respecting that there is still, you know, this very sinister virus going around causing harm.
Yeah. And you've touched on something there that is important when it comes to advocacy. You know, it's knowing someone who didn't get better. And it is mobilizing the people who didn't get better to have a strong voice back to governments. And, you know, in Australia, it's our members of parliament, to you, it's Congress, to keep front and center that these people are not getting better. This is not something that is going away that you're going to be able to sweep under the carpet.
Yeah, exactly. And then, I mean, even making sure that when there is allocated funding, you know, such as our NIH initiative, Recover, and other, you know, global funding, state level funding, et cetera, we have to be able to inform at that level too, right? Because we've all seen time and time again that while well-intentioned, without having those patient partners, without having those lived experience professionals at the table, that funding can get used up very quickly and not produce results that then end up helping patients, right? That clinical trial that could have been game-changing, or we know from a clinical practice side that that medication works, if structured wrong or they don't have the appropriate endpoints, and then we didn't use that opportunity to its, you know, potential. So,
or ensuring that the voice of the person with lived experience is included from the outset rather than an afterthought.
Exactly. They need to be a part of the study design. They need to, you know, be a part of what assessment points are we using? Is this even realistic as someone with the illness to be able to track this? I mean, there's so many studies that are just set up to fail. And then that then means, well, there went an accessible intervention that someone might be able to get in someday, or that insurance might actually approve so that more people can get it. So to your point, we have so many layers of both education and advocacy that can impact the care and resources that people get.
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm just going to ask you something about the clinical care guide before I go back and ask you a question about PEM. So you've led the development of the clinical care guide, which you've talked about, and that really is a groundbreaking resource for clinicians managing ME/CFS and long COVID. What inspired this project, and how do you see this guide transforming clinical practice and improve patient care?
A big part of the inspiration came from my own experience working in large health systems and academic medical centers, and then coming to Bateman Horne Center and seeing just how different BHC's approach to care is. And it kind of goes back to something we talked about earlier, which is that whole person approach. Like, I watch these providers and I listen to how they, you know, educate and talk to their patients about these illnesses, and they really look at the whole pathology that's driving the illness, not working in silos of systems. And so as I was thinking through, how do we make this change, you know, from the inside out, it starts with allowing a roadmap that's accessible to more providers, regardless of their, you know, setting and the constraints around their practice, to pick something up and say, okay, I'm going to be able to help a patient who's describing dysautonomia. I'm going to be able to help a patient who's, you know, describing symptoms of ME/CFS. I'm not quite sure how to start. How do I break this into 15-minute visits with this person? Well, at least they have a guide that gets them there, and it's something tangible. So it took a lot, so many months to create the clinical care guide and pull together the didactics from all of the providers over the last, I think it was about 5 years at that point, and create this kind of consensus of standardization and how they were approaching, you know, each of these components of our whole management process, and then put that into words. The other thing that I really enjoyed doing with, it was mainly Melanie Hoppers. She and I partnered together, and then we had a really amazing group of multidisciplinary professionals that worked with us on their specific chapters. But as a core theme, we wanted to also ensure that whatever doctor, local provider that's seeing these patients, that they understand that they're actually the quarterback of that patient's care, right? And that doesn't just mean prescribing and writing a medication and hoping it works. It means that you have the duty and responsibility to help that caregiver, that loved one, that spouse, whomever is caring for that patient. You have a duty to support them too. You know, you have a duty to call in other allied professionals to help that person outside of your clinic walls. Help them live inside their home. Find those supports for them, you know? So that was another theme. And giving voice to the most severe, because they're so missed in our patient population, as are these pediatric patients. And so that was a special part of the evolution of our clinical care guides development. And now we're hoping to be able to, you know, capitalize on the momentum that we started last year, where our board members who are clinicians, they sent the clinical care guide to med schools all throughout the United States. And then we had a really special donor buy copies of the clinical care guide from Amazon. And then we had the community say, this is my provider, I want you to send it here. And so we sent, I think it was 143 or 163, can't remember, copies of the clinical care guide directly to providers' doorsteps in rural and urban America. And so we really want to keep that momentum going, bring this to our Federation of State Medical Boards, bring this to our credentialing groups, and just continue to try to infiltrate this into medical education sooner in these young providers' lives.
Yeah, it's interesting hearing you speak. The differences in our health systems just sort of hit you in the face, because that is the complexity that we talked about before that I think comes with a nation like the United States that's got such a large population compared to Australia anyway. And we haven't got everything that we need yet. Once we get the clinical guidelines, once handbooks have been rewritten, changing health pathways that currently still advise graded exercise therapy and cognitive behavioral therapy, and that they're on their way out. But once everything hinges on the clinical guideline, and once that's done, it is much easier to get to all of our clinicians and centres across the country just because of the way our system is designed. So we can work through primary health networks, of which there are 31 across the country, and they help us with that, and then we do the clinical education. So, yeah, I feel for you because the challenges are so big with such a large population base.
Yeah, I mean, when we started talking a couple years ago and, you know, starting to form our collaboration, when you describe the way that you were able to reach the general practitioners in through that system, I just thought that we need more of that, right? And then making sure that the right people are positioned to give that education, you know, such as yourselves, it's so critical. And so I'm not even sure everyone listening to the podcast, but especially those throughout Australia, even realize how important the work that Emerge Australia has done in that way, and how influential your efforts are, because you are able to reach that level and you take it so seriously.
Oh, thank you for that. That's really lovely. But, you know, our work is built on the shoulders of organizations like yours and Dr. Bateman. And, you know, the collaboration we have is just a really precious one for us. So we want to keep that going and do more really good and innovative work in the future. So I'm going to go back to a question that I've got here on post-exertional malaise. And, you know, you'll have some personal experience and obviously your professional knowledge. So often PEM is described as a severe crash after physical or mental exertion, but what does PEM actually feel like? And pardon me, what's its impact on people's daily lives?
Yeah, PEM is incredibly debilitating. It's also so difficult to explain unless you've unfortunately experienced it. And being completely transparent, I did not understand the severity of what it feels like until I started feeling it myself after COVID. And so I can really only speak to my experience, but then also having worked with so many patients, seeing how my sister has described this, it's this bone crushing fatigue that just does not resolve with rest. And I don't mean the kind of tired that you would get after, you know, going on a long hike or having a hard workout and you can like sleep and recover. This stays with you in this heavy cloud kind of way. And, you know, my brain when I'm in PEM will feel almost on fire, or like it has like an intense pressure to it. I've heard patients describe their arms and legs feeling like concrete, trying to move through, you know, the earth. And some of the warning signs that patients will describe, almost like a heaviness and tightness in their eyes. They'll start to find that they're having difficulty with forming sentences, concentrating. Other more physiologic symptoms will come through with this kind of sharp ice pick feeling, headache in the back of their head. They'll start sweating, dizziness, start to get nauseous, and they know at that point, I've crossed a line and I need to stop. I think the cruel part about PEM, beyond just the symptoms that it exacerbates, is that this can happen with even small amounts of physical, cognitive, or emotional exertion, and are often compounded then by environmental, hormonal, and orthostatic stressors that are draining that energy or that battery behind the scenes without the patient even realizing it until it's too late, you know, and then once in PEM, it's so cruel because your brain still wants to work, but you're kind of stuck inside this body that doesn't want to work. So I think it's the hardest thing for a patient to describe to providers, and yet it is so, so important for medical professionals to hear when a patient is describing this, because once again, they have the duty to say, we need to slow you down. I need to find ways to support you at home. Maybe that means that we need more home supports. Maybe that means that you need a short-term disability stent to get out of this deep crash. Maybe it means work accommodations or school accommodations. They have a duty to reach patients sooner. And because PEM is such a debilitating aspect of this illness, I think if there's anything that a provider can learn, it's that. Recognize it and support the patient there first.
Yeah, that I think you just raised a really critical point for no matter what country we're in, that recognizing PEM sooner is just, you know, it's at the core of everything. It also comes to the earlier the diagnosis of ME/CFS, the better for the patient. So recognizing all of the aspects that the patient is going through. And, you know, you mentioned, you know, that we might need to put other supports in, et cetera. That in Australia is probably a little bit more problematic than it may be in the United States, especially when you're talking about disability supports. We have quite a few systemic challenges because our system doesn't really recognize ME/CFS in the way that we need it to be, because it's such a fluctuating disease. It's a disease of fluctuating energy. So how it's defined as far as a disability is concerned for financial or in-home supports is a challenge for us in Australia. We're working on it. We're working with our government agency, but it's a slow burn. And in the meantime, patients suffer.
Exactly. Exactly. And I would say that although there may be access to a lot of resources here, it really hinges on the system's, even in the United States, willingness to believe and see this. And I think, too, we're so used to defining function by way of productivity and like, okay, well, you can sit upright, so you must be functional, or you got dressed for work, so you must be functional. And yet there is this whole other definition of what it means to be a functioning human being in life, right? And so I think it's also a matter of, once again, redefining how we diagnose conditions and what goes into, you know, the core components of disability itself.
Yeah. And that's a huge issue for us. Another issue that just came into my mind as I was listening to you speak is the one that I'm starting to get into here in Australia. And that is, so our federal government, you know, last year allocated a lot of money to women's health. They allocated a lot of money to domestic violence. In that women's health bucket, you know, there are all the women's health issues like endometriosis, you know, menopause, perimenopause. And what we seem to forget is that someone with ME/CFS, in this case a female, because 75% of people, as we know, with ME/CFS are female, we seem to forget that all those other issues, whether it be domestic violence, whether it be perimenopause or menopause or endometriosis or any of the other women's health issues that money is being poured into, women with ME/CFS have those issues on top of their ME/CFS.
Yes. Thank you. Yes, you're exactly right. It kind of goes back to that whole pathology. We can't just silo this. Yes. Right? Yeah.
And so part of what I am figuring out in my own mind, but also trying to advocate for, is that the buckets of money that governments allocate for various diseases, in our case, women's health, that they are cognizant of the fact that don't just silo women with ME/CFS over in that bucket, and that bucket involves stopping gaslighting, you know, providing GP education, etc. And that's all we can do for that bucket, because they're completely and totally denying the impact of all these other women's health issues, let alone men's health issues on men with ME/CFS. But we're putting things into silos, and by doing that, we are missing huge opportunities to help people who've got an underlying ME/CFS condition.
Absolutely. And I mean, so much of what you describe drives so many other components of that ME/CFS presentation and pathology. I mean, think about, you know, the whole hormonal fluctuation in and of itself in women around their monthly cycles, and then how volatile that gets in perimenopause and menopause. That contributes to so many other pathologies that are driving that underlying mast cell with the estrogen dominance, underlying, you know, dysautonomia and the POTS fluctuations. All of that impacts PEM, and you'll notice those PEM cycles get worse around that same time every month. And to your point, if we just keep them in these little buckets, we're missing the opportunity to understand, one, how this all fits together, but how we support the whole patient, right? How is this connective tissue component playing into more of this endometriosis? How can we not call mast cell forward when we're talking about PCOS and endometriosis? You know, we can't do it in silos. Or, well, we do, but it's not the right approach. And so we're not then serving the whole patient.
Yes, yes. Well, watch this space for us, because that's an area that I'm really keen to impact. It's certainly an area we need more research on. I'm certainly very keen to advocate to our federal government about the need to be inclusive of women with ME/CFS. And the same thing applies for domestic violence.
Yes.
Because we know that as a result of the significant grief and loss that a person with ME/CFS suffers from, it does lead to tensions in some families. And in some families, there is hidden domestic violence that, unless we work to uncover that and include those people in the strategies that are being put forward to end domestic violence, then those people with ME/CFS are going to continue to be marginalized.
I'm so glad you're brave and vulnerable enough to call that forward, because you're so right. And once again, I don't mean to keep harping back on definition, but I think when people think about domestic violence, they think of physical abuse, but there are those silent domestic violence approaches when you live with a chronic illness, or you are being, you know, supported by someone and you don't understand. I mean, neglect, the emotional and mental abuse that can come from, you know, family members and loved ones not understanding. This kind of goes back to what we had said earlier about the provider being the quarterback of that care. It's their responsibility to help support that whole family system. And that may mean sitting down with the caregiver or the spouse or whomever and saying, this is a really real disease. And you may not understand this because you haven't experienced it, but let me help support you too, right? And you need to be, you know, supporting your loved one in X, Y, and Z ways. I think it's just, we don't talk about it. So it becomes this taboo thing that eventually just gets swept under the rug. And so I'm so glad that you are calling that forward.
Yeah, I mean, I've got a long, long way to go. But I see it as an issue, and I specifically see it and hear it when our members of parliament talk about, you know, their area of women's health. And I go, well, it's our area as well. Or their area of domestic violence. Well, what do you think? It happens in every other community, but not in people with ME/CFS. I don't think so.
Exactly. You're exactly right.
So as someone who has worked so closely with Dr. Lucinda Bateman, who of course joined us, you know, I think about 18 months ago, and it's probably time I did write to Dr. Bateman and said, I think it might be time we had another chat. You've witnessed the growth of Bateman Horne Center. Can you share with us some of the key lessons that you've learned about, and it'll touch a little bit on what you've already said, about leadership, the power of collaboration in driving systemic change for rare and complex diseases like ME/CFS?
Yeah. First and foremost, I love that you are recognizing Dr. Bateman, because she is truly a pioneer in this work. And she is incredibly humble as a person. And so she will not take the stand and acknowledge that herself. So we must do it for her. But she has taught me so much about leading with grace and grit, and finding that balance in how you must remain resilient in pushing forward for change and staying humble in that process, because that keeps you connected to the real people going through this, right? That keeps you connected to the roots of the patients living with these conditions. And so I think she is the master of networking and collaborating. She's able to, you know, bring together scientists and researchers and clinicians and patients and advocates in a way that keeps us all rowing in the same direction, even when it's being controlled by, you know, a federal institution or an initiative or something like that with RECOVER. It's been amazing to watch her, and I'm so honored that I had the time and space with her to keep learning. And so I hope that we can continue to make her proud in moving this field forward and honoring what she and many others in this field have helped pioneer for all of us.
Yeah, that's fantastic and so beautiful. Finally, in ME/CFS Awareness Week, with a focus on PEM, what message of hope and resilience would you like to share with our listeners, especially those living with ME/CFS and their support networks?
I think the message I'd want to share is that you're not alone, even when it feels that way. In my time with Bateman Horne in this field in particular, I am seeing change. It is hard to sometimes feel, especially when you are confined to your bed or your home and you are waiting for someone to figure this out. There are more providers that are willing to learn. There is more research happening, and tangible research with modalities and interventions that will become accessible to more people. And there are so many individuals in this field trying to ensure that this invisible illness still has a voice, and that these people's experiences are honored, and that it matters, right? And so I would just say, hold on to hope. I know that that can sometimes feel both painful and isolating at times, and yet it's what we have. And I really do see progress being made, and that gives me hope for all of us who are living with this illness.
That's a beautiful note to end on. Thank you so much for being our guest today, Talia. I love hearing what you have to say, and I think you and I probably need to have some discussions offline about how we can collaborate on some of these other projects, which I think would be very interesting to do together. So thank you so much. So today's
thank you podcast, for having me.
Oh, that's a pleasure. Today's podcast is part of our World ME Awareness Week series that Emerge Australia is recording with those living with ME/CFS. This is a platform where we can together explore the pressing issues faced by 250,000 people with ME/CFS and at least 400,000 more with long COVID in Australia. If the content of this or other Emerge Australia podcast has triggered an emotional response for which you need assistance, feel free to contact Lifeline 131114, their Crisis Support and Suicide Prevention Service. You may also wish to go onto the Emerge Australia website, where emergency services are listed. This has been a wonderful podcast with Talia Ruscioni, who's the Executive Director of the Bateman Horne Center. There's been so much food for thought in the comments that Talia has made, and also describing what the challenges are that her organization faces in ensuring that we have a greater impact and we're able to provide greater support and service to people within our community. So, Talia, thank you again from me.
Thank you, Anne.
Tune in again for our next interview, and don't forget, for more information and to subscribe to the Emerge Australia newsletter, visit our website on www.emerge.org.au. Thank you again, Talia, and bye for now.
You may say that I